This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you're finding it, and share it with people you think should know about it. One of the very first things that Donald Trump did after being sworn in as president was to make good on promises to reduce both legal and illegal immigration. He even issued an executive order ending birthright citizenship, a right guaranteed by the Constitution's 14th Amendment. That order has already been blocked by a federal judge, and its fate may well end up being decided by the Supreme Court. But calls for less immigration are super popular, with 55% of Americans saying current levels should be decreased. That's the highest since 2001. I disagree with that. I think immigration is a good thing and that we should have more of it done in an orderly, peaceful, efficient fashion. So on January 21st, the day after Trump's inauguration, I asked George Mason University economist Brian Kaplan and Cato Institute analyst Alex Narasta to make the libertarian case for more immigration at a live event in New York City. They've written extensively on the topic, and I think we answer every question and concern anybody might have about immigration. The goal here was to steelman critics of immigration and explain why more newcomers is a good thing for our culture, our economy, and our country. Here is The Reason Interview with Brian Kaplan and Alex Narasta. All right, well, let's start talking, and we will then move through a couple of different sections of this. But first off, Alex, we are, you know, a day one plus or one and a half, I don't know, whatever, into the Trump administration. Donald Trump, both in 2016, but then especially in this past election cycle, you know, campaigned on limiting immigration, getting rid of illegals, et cetera. What did he do in day one? He promised a very big day one related to immigration. What was the primary outcome of what he did? And is this a good or bad thing?
So he promised to reduce legal immigration and illegal immigration. If you look back to his effects during his first administration, the biggest effect he had was on reducing the legal immigrant population and inflows, not the illegal during his time. And what he did was he declared an invasion, that there is an invasion going on along the border. He had multiple paragraphs explaining and trying to argue that there was an invasion. Usually you don't need multiple paragraphs to describe an invasion. Like, you just know, like, hey, the Nazis are coming, they're here. Like, you know, when that happens, you try to justify it. And then as a result of that, says, because there's an invasion, extraordinary powers, he shut down the asylum system, making it virtually impossible to apply for asylum along the border. Also, that part of the Constitution that's activated allows states to wage war. I'm not sure how they're going to wage war on immigration along the border, but we'll see as things develop. There are some pretty creative border state governors. He also shut down the refugee system for this year. It's a temporary pause, he says. But given the numbers that have already come in, it's shutting down at least for the rest of the year. He has declared the drug cartels to be foreign terrorist organizations. So now when anybody is killed along the border in a drug dispute, it's going to be considered an act of terrorism. This is important because not a single American has been killed by an illegal immigrant in a terrorist attack in the last 50 years, as far as we can tell, despite him talking about it frequently. And he also issued an executive order that seeks to modify the rules about birthright citizenship. Basically, we call it the Kamala Harris order because it is designed, I think, specifically to troll Kamala Harris, to basically remove citizenship from her, because the way that it's defined would basically apply to her. And
could you very briefly explain that?
So if you don't have a parent who is a lawful permanent resident or a citizen when you're born, then you won't be considered a citizen starting in about 30 days for people born after that. Now, if the courts uphold that, then, of course, they're going to expand it and try to go backwards as far as possible. He also declared all manner of emergency along the border that allows him to activate enormous amount of funds to basically be able to redirect military construction funds unilaterally to build the border, to deploy the National Guard if he wants to along the border, to do all manner of other types of military operations.
Could you very quickly, I know both you and your colleague at Cato, David Beer, have written about this extensively. Trump, in his first term, he was particularly going after illegal immigrants, but he ended up actually kind of cutting legal immigration more than illegal immigration. And that seems counterintuitive. What was going on with that?
So I think it's actually more intuitive than not, because the president has control over the legal system. He can adjust that almost any way that he wants, thanks to some really stupid Supreme Court decisions during his term. But it's a black market, illegal immigration. He has less control over that. Sure, he can adjust the incentives and the deterrent by building up border security or other types of measures, but he has the most direct control over the legal system. And so that is what he adjusted. And if you read his platform that he put out for 2016, I know it's funny, like a Trump platform, like, haha, whatever. But it said in there specifically he wanted to cut legal immigration by 2/3. And then by the time of COVID, he exceeded that. Part of that, of course, is in reaction to the pandemic. But even before then, he cut student visas, skilled immigration, all manner of work visas, et cetera.
Before we go to Brian, I want to just follow up with one other point. How do we know that there is not an invasion of America? Or that's the wrong term to put it. But under Joe Biden, a massive number of immigrants, legal and illegal, entered the country. Why is it wrong to characterize that as an invasion?
So I think there is a big difference, right, between the Germans going to Paris in 1940 and, you know, 100,000 of them ahead of an army and 100,000 Germans going today to get jobs. You know, it's not a military invasion. It's not a conquest. They are coming here because Americans demand their labor and want to hire them. We've had an extraordinarily large number of job openings for the last 5 years after the recovery of COVID. Americans want to hire them. They want to rent apartments to them. They want to sell them goods and services in mutually beneficial and voluntary exchanges, right? Like a foreign army doesn't come to repair your deck. But these people are coming to, they come to blow it up, right? But immigrants are coming to build it and to supply the goods and services that we want to buy and consume. And I'm sure some of them are bad people, but.
Yeah. Well, some of us are bad people too, right? Brian, what do you mean as a libertarian, and you talk to people and they say, oh, you're a libertarian, so you believe in open borders. What do you mean by open borders?
Well, let's see. I got to debate for Intelligence Squared a few years ago, and the resolution was let anyone take a job anywhere. I think that's a good slogan. I think of open borders as a slogan of human beings should be able to go and move back and forth between countries, live and work without government permission. If you say, well, does that mean open regardless of whether the person shows up carrying an axe? Of course not. I'd say that's just understood in terms of normal English. A way that I've sometimes explained it, which is if you don't belong in jail, then you should be able to go and move back and forth freely between countries, right? Because open borders also doesn't mean open up the jails, right?
Are you talking about a kind of Ellis Island style? I mean, there would be some place where people would show their passport or something like that. Or do we, abolish borders completely?
I mean, honestly, I'd say that's just a detail and it's just not very important. I mean, like, it's true if you say, well, like, you have to show a passport. Well, if you've driven around the EU, you don't have to show passports to go between those countries. You don't need to show a passport to go between Virginia and Maryland. Doesn't that mean that an axe murderer from Maryland could freely go into Virginia and attack people? It does, actually. However, it's really convenient for everybody else. So the idea of just actually having no checks at all and you can come and go freely, I think that a case for that is way stronger than what most people think, because it's very inconvenient to have to get checked. As you will know, if you have actually gone through passport control, it's like, wow, this is a pain in the neck. All right. But I don't regard that as an important issue. I say, look, if you just have to go and show your passport, all right, fine. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, honestly, the main thing to understand is that for tourists, this pain in the neck cost is actually pretty serious and probably greatly reduces tourism because it's a large percentage of the gain you're getting from going to that other country. There's been some interesting work saying that just requiring visas cuts international travel to your country by about 70%.
Why do so many countries insist on visas?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's mostly just total paranoia and national pride. I actually got to be on a panel with Modi's top economic advisor in India. And when I mentioned this, he just got quite, it was the Montpellier Society. I mentioned, since he was in charge of getting rid of a bunch of stupid regulations, I said, here's one that you might consider. And since almost everybody there was not from India, there's wild applause. And then he said, well, we will do it when the United States gives us visa-free travel. And I'm like, okay, I think that would be great, but that's not going to happen for the obvious reason that very few Americans want to move to India and start working there. And a lot of Indians would like to move to the U.S. and start working there. And when you have a system designed to prevent people from working, that is a large part of the fear of immigration systems, that someone might move to your country and try to produce something.
And one of the interesting things is before World War I, there were only two countries in the world that required passports. Those beacons of freedom and liberty in Europe, the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire, and the rest of the world seems to have converged to those standards during the war.
So tell me, Alex, what happened? Because, America, broadly speaking, goes through, from the colonial period really on, but goes through waves of being kind of pro-immigrant and anti-immigrant. It doesn't necessarily match up with whether or not people are moving here or not. But, we go through cycles of this. And over the past few years, there has been an intense antipathy that has had, has political force to say, we have too much immigration. We, legal and illegal. Things are out of control. What is driving that perception?
The chaos at the border. The chaos at the border caused by the virtual impossibility for the vast majority of immigrants to come here legally. Wages in the United States, depending on how you measure, like 3 to 15 times higher, adjusting for the cost of living than in other countries. There's enormous demand for these people to come here. The job market, job openings have been extraordinary for the last several years in the United States. Americans want to hire them. And so a lot more people have been coming. And, there have been some changes in terms of policy on the border, but in terms of the effect of those changes by Biden on illegal immigration, they're vastly overstated. For instance, December 2020, the month before Trump left office, was the highest December to that point in terms of border apprehensions in 21 years. Because the job market was recovering quite greatly after the end of COVID.
People and, getting and back and apprehensions as a proxy for the number of people who also get through.
It's a people use it as a proxy for that, but it's a real measure of the chaos, right? And I don't think anybody, I certainly don't look at these pictures of large numbers of people coming across being apprehended, sometimes a little mini riot. Sometimes they assault Border Patrol officers or scale walls. I don't like that. I'm a libertarian, but I do like order. I like some laws, but I like order a lot. And I think that, but this is a chaos that is born and created from laws that are hyper restrictive and that prevent people from engaging in the mutually beneficial voluntary exchanges that they want. So I think the chaos is driving a large percentage of it.
Can I say something on that?
Yeah.
So I think it is a bit more complicated in a few ways. First of all, I'm not convinced there was ever a period when immigration was popular in the U.S. Right.
When you if you look at Gallup, which asks the same question to representative groups, actually under Trump, the people who agreed with the sentiment that immigrants have mostly been a benefit to the country went up to about 75%, the highest they recorded. It's now below 50%. So that's what I'm
about. So let me look this way. So we've actually got data going – I think it is Gallup data going back from the 60s. So the share of the U.S. population that favored more immigration was in single digits for many decades. I mean, basically from like the beginning around 1965 up to about 2000, it would generally be under 10% of Americans said there should be more immigration. This is at a time when immigration was lower. And then around 2000, it started going up. It is true, I think in the last couple of years, it went down a bit from its historic peak. But and then if you just go back to the 19th century, you don't have public opinion data from then. So it's hard to know. But I don't there's enough nativist movements and enough moves to go and restrict immigration. Like, why was there ever open borders? There's this great paper on how open borders ended in six countries that just goes over U.S., Canada, Argentina, Brazil, New Zealand. And
What's the answer?
So honestly, the answer is they don't know, but it did end in six countries. And I mean, I think the main thing you can say is that the easy stories are wrong. It's not just that objective facts change in some way and then people rationally responded to them. And in general, I would just say that while political advisors like the idea that public opinion is moving in response to facts, we have a lot of evidence that that is not so. Public opinion moves in response to perceptions, which themselves really have very little to do with facts. I don't know about immigration, but for example, there's a fantastic paper on perceived versus actual inequality around the world. And here's the quick version of that paper. The correlation between actual inequality in a country and perceived inequality by the people who live in that country is 0.2, which is barely noticeable. And the correlation between perceived changes in inequality and actual changes in inequality is 0. So when you see the people are getting upset about inequality and say, oh, it's because inequality is so high, it's it's got nothing to do with it. It's just that people get upset about stuff and it's got almost nothing to do with numbers, which is no surprise when you realize how people don't like math.
What happens in the political economy, though, because, with the major wide-scale immigration restrictions in the United States that were ultimately voted in 1924, there was about a 40-year period that was coincidental with a massive increase in the number of people coming from Europe, where politicians working with community leaders, et cetera, created a groundswell for a series of acts that passed pretty overwhelmingly in Congress. So what goes into that? Why and I guess more so now, how does that map onto, the anxieties and the concerns that, it's clear Trump campaigned as, he was going to cut immigration and that, people responded to that pretty strongly.
Yeah, so Alex may know a lot more than me, but so you're talking about the 1924 Act and why that passed. All right. So basically, there's a whole series of Immigration Restrictions Acts. I had a grad student that went through all the ones that failed as well as all the ones that succeeded from 1870 up till not sure when it ended. But anyway, the main story is that all the complaints that you hear about immigrants now were also very widely shared in that period from late 19th century up to early 20th century. Every complaint you've heard about crime and effect on labor markets and effect on culture, all that stuff was around. It was very subtle differences. The main thing is that anti-immigration people in those days talked about our Nordic race, right, which is the actual language that they would use. And when they said immigration will destroy our Nordic race, turns out they were right, because any Nordics around here? I don't know any Nordics. So now you realize, it's really just a change in change in self identity.
They're hiding right now. They're dyeing their hair black.
Yes, in terms of how it passed, there was just a lot of negativity towards immigrants for a long time. They managed to get over the hump, but it doesn't seem like it was particularly even then. There was some stuff about some socialist terrorists, anarchist terrorists after World War I, but. It's very easy after the fact to say, well, there's some scandals right before, but there's always scandals.
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
I mean, there were concerted movements to pass laws that would restrict immigrants from coming. And then the question is, how do you get the people to come out and vote for that or for it to be pushed top down? I mean, Alex, do you have a sense of what we might learn from the restrictionist movement in the early part of the 20th century? And now, are they following the same script?
Oh, it's very similar. I mean, they tried multiple times. I mean, there was a law passed in the late 1890s that basically would have done then what they did in 1924. And it passed, but it was vetoed. And there are a couple other bills like this that were vetoed. They had some restrictions that they were able to put in, but they were very persistent. They were very dedicated. They had a clear cause that everyone could understand. And then I think you had a few things happen in the 19-teens, right? You had World War I that stopped a lot of immigration. I think people were like, oh, this is pretty good. We don't have all these boats of these gross foreigners coming in, I think is the way that they were thinking about it. And then I do think some of the perceptions of chaos and the real chaos. There were hundreds of bombings across the United States. The socialist revolution in Russia convinced actually some businesses for the first time to support closing the border because they were afraid of that. Because the old nativist organizations, when they failed in their laws, it was a politically incorrect phrase, but they would basically blame the, quote, Jews, Jesuits, and steamships. Jews being obvious, they didn't like them. Jesuits being Catholics, they don't like them very much. Big lobbies for immigration, but steamships being a stand-in for firms that benefited from immigration. And there was a bit of a sea change in the early 20s where you had some big industrialists come out because they were sort of worried about these red bombings. So I think it's the, you know, you have a the nativists have a persistent message. It's very easy to communicate. There's a lot of popularity from it. And then when you have some break in the system or some deviation from the normal trends and some chaos, it's a way to take advantage of it. You also had a huge labor movement that was growing that was fiercely nativist, inspired by eugenics ideology that saw northern and that saw southern and eastern Europeans, who were the main immigrant groups, as being inferior. There was a a book written at the time called The Melting Pot Mistake, published in the 1920s, about the about how, you know, Eastern Europeans, Jews, and Southern Europeans would never assimilate to our great Nordic ways.
Although, you know, while we're talking about the greater regulation of immigration, also worth remembering. So 1965, we have this act that heavily deregulates immigration. Although if you know the legislative history, how do you pronounce the guy's name? G-J-E-L-T-N?
Jilton.
Yeah. Right. So he goes over the actual legislative history. It's fascinating because it appears that the liberalization of immigration was a complete mistake. The people that were involved did not intend it. And rather, it was basically, we want to keep America white without being racist anymore. So what can we do? Let's make family reunification the basis for immigration. There's nothing racist about families, is there? Just coincidentally, most people here are white, so their families will be white, right? And they just didn't seem to realize the effect of chain migration, in particular saying that brothers and sisters, siblings would count as relatives for purposes of family unification. And also the fact that most white Americans wouldn't have foreign relatives to bring over, whereas non-whites would. I think there's some story of a Nigerian doctor who was the basis for 150 Nigerians getting in. Right. And the logic is simple. It's like, if you can let in your brothers and sisters, then you can get in their spouses. And if their spouses get in, they can get in their brothers and sisters and so on. And so really, it looks like this was not a response to anything other than Cold War and wanting to have better PR. But they actually led to a massive increase in immigration, combined with this feature of the U.S., which is once you pass legislation, it's really hard to unpass it.
So tell Brian, what is the case for more immigration? Because a lot of people, and, you know, last year, I guess, I was part of a free press debate with Sohrab Amari and Ann Coulter on the other side, and they pointed Ann in particular to that 65 law, which had many unintended consequences as when the shit hit the fan. Why is it good that that Nigerian doctor brings over 150 of his closest relatives?
Yeah, great point. So I recently wrote an open letter to Elon Musk, which is called E of X is Greater Than Zero. Just to begin with the kind of immigration that almost every rational person wants. It's like, well, we want Albert Einstein. We want geniuses. We want people that found companies. We want baseball players and movie stars, right? Why? Because those people add value. All right. It's like, all right, so far so good. Yeah, they do add value. They add a lot of value. It's like, but then once you can admit that these very high-skilled immigrants are adding a lot of value, then the question is, all right, well, are they the only people add value? It's like, do you need to add $100 billion worth of value to be a worthwhile person? It's like, no. How about people only add $1 billion? Yeah, they're good too. All right, how about people only add like $10 million? Yeah, them. How about people only add $1 million? Good. How about people add 100,000? Right, and so on. Right, so you know, the way that I was explaining this to Elon, I don't think he read it, but I'm still, anyway, if you got a line to him, it would only take 5 minutes of his time,
he could do it in 2 minutes. Yes. He's very smart. Yeah.
You know, when you're running a company, it is not the case that the janitors are parasites on the rest of the company. Right? The janitors, they don't contribute as much as the CEO, but they are still valuable people who more than pull their weight. And if you look at immigration that way, you realize, wow, people who are generally very low skilled, they take care of kids, they mow lawns, they grow food. Why is it that people are so eager to keep people out just because they are low skilled? And again, we can be totally honest and say, look, they are not Albert Einstein, without saying, therefore, we don't want them. And I say, that's really the basic economic case, is saying, let in all the people that actually are better than nothing. and which is almost everybody's better than nothing.
And I so, like Panda
Alex,
Express.
Can I ask Alex? You have done work on kind of quantifying though the amount of benefits, you know, of tax-funded benefits that immigrants get, particularly low-skilled immigrants. This is an argument that comes up again and again, which is to say, well, you know, in the 20s, you know, those Jews and Jesuits, you know, whatever else you can say about them is that they weren't getting, you know, temporary assistance for needy families and things like that. They weren't going to public schools that cost $30,000 a year. How does that factor in, that calculation factor into that argument of saying let them all in?
So when you take a look at the welfare consumption of people who are foreign born compared to native born Americans, it's on average 27% less, the dollar value, when you look at the entirety of means tested and entitlement programs in the United States. So it's 27% less. That's partly for a handful of reasons. One is they are legally restricted from certain benefits for periods of time, especially when for the first 5 years that they are here lawfully. Illegal immigrants have very little access to benefits. It depends on some state policies, but they have access to a handful of benefits in a few states, but not very many. Public school is the big one. But of course, the other side of the calculation is the taxes, right? So it's the value of the services that they consume, and it's the taxes that they pay. But it's not just what they pay specifically, but also the taxes paid from the extra economic activity that results from them being here, right? So the higher corporate profits from being able to expand production and sell more goods and services, from everything like that, from the higher property values, because there's more people who are buying property. So property tax revenue goes up even if the rates remain the same. And when you balance that up, there's a lot of different research on both sides, a lot of really boring models that go back and forth. I spent a whole summer reading them. I think you read that working paper one time. It was like the most boring summer ever, because basically the results—
You got that right.
Oh, yeah. Basically the result was that they mostly pay their way. There's some variation here. Sometimes some lower skilled immigrants don't on average. Sometimes they do based on the model and the methods of it. But basically, immigration is not driving any the fiscal problems in the U.S. government. The fiscal problems are being spent by tax and budget policies outside of that. So, but I want to say if that still concerns you, the easy answer is to build a higher wall around the welfare state, not around the country.
Is that, I agree with you, but is that really plausible? Because, you know, when you say, you know, they on average immigrants take 27% less in transfer payments than native born people, why isn't it zero? Or should it be zero?
It should be zero for everybody. But yeah, if we can only make it zero for immigrants, then I would do that right away. The thing is, the most successful long-term part of the 1996 Welfare Reform Act was permanently reducing immigrant welfare use substantially below that of native-born Americans. And most, not all, but most of those restrictions have stuck around. And I do have a feeling that we're going to have more restrictions on immigrant access to welfare in the next couple of years, which is would be one of the few things good on immigration policy that would come out of this administration.
Brian, could you talk about the job impacts of immigrants, whether they're high-skilled or low-skilled? This is also a major argument against, you know, more immigration or immigration in general, is that immigrants come here and they take our jobs, and they take our jobs, whether we're in Silicon Valley or whether we're pool cleaners in Southern California. Is that accurate?
The correct way to start is to say, well, if you are directly competing with an immigrant, then probably they're bad for you in the labor market. Letting in a bunch of foreign PhD economists is bad for me. All right. On the other hand, if they are immigrants, these immigrants that produce what you produce are bad for you. However, immigrants who produce what you consume are good for you. When you let in Afghan restaurateurs into my area, I'm not worried about losing my job. I'm saying, wow, now my money buys more and better stuff. So for any person, you can say you need to at least consider both the fact that they are competing with you for jobs, but also competing with your money, competing for your money, competing with you for your jobs is bad for you, competing for your money is good for you, and then say, well, what's the net effect? And that is where we can go back to what should be taught on the first day of every Econ 1 class, and it's this. The secret of mass consumption is mass production. All rich countries are countries that produce a lot of stuff per person. Right. And as long as you're in a country where there's very high production per person, it is almost certain that you too will have at least a reasonably good standard of living. And this is the heart of the economic case for immigration, which is that we know for a fact that when you let in someone from a poor country into a rich country, their productivity skyrockets overnight. It's really obvious for agriculture. You let a Mexican farmer in to work on a U.S. farm and he's suddenly growing 10 times as much food as he was back in Mexico. That's just fact. You let in someone who's working in a primitive factory in India to a modern Western factory, he's suddenly producing a lot more. That's fact. The only one that's a little puzzling is what about a service like shining shoes? It's not like a Haitian shines more shoes in Miami than he does back in Haiti, right? And the answer there is for services, you have to remember the point of a service is to save time. And when you save more valuable time, you contribute more to the world. So if you save 5 minutes of Bill Gates' time, you have done more for the world than when you save 5 minutes of my time. And that's why services actually do also enrich humanity. When you leave Haiti and move to the U.S., you are now saving the time of people's time is worth 10 times as much. And that's where that extra productivity comes. So I'd say that the best way to think about this is say at first it's ambiguous and then you realize, no, it's not ambiguous at all because you need to keep your eye on the ball of production. When you were increasing total production, you were increasing the wealth of humanity. And there is no example in economic history, at least none that I am aware of, where there was a large increase in production that was not broadly shared. It is not the case that building textile factories just enrich factory owners, not the case that vaccines only enrich pharmaceutical companies. It's not that the internet just enrich programmers. When you produce abundance, the abundance winds up being shared through normal market processes.
Alex, we've heard a lot over the past few weeks or months about H-1B visas and how immigrants are taking advantage of those and pulling money out of American pockets. Of actual workers and potential workers. Can you just very quickly explain what the H-1B visa program is and whether or not that critique of it is accurate?
The H-1B visa is a temporary high-skilled visa program for people. It's a minimum wage of $60,000. It's a 3-year visa, renewable once, and the company can sponsor you for a green card. And so long as you're working for them, you can work on that. The backlog for it is tremendous for certain countries to get that green card because the visa, the green card system, which is the first step to becoming a citizen, so people go oftentimes from student to H-1B to green card. The backlog is per country, so only 7% of people who get a green card each year can come from any one country. So the backlog for some Indians in some visa and some green card categories is about 150 years. Like, if you ordered a car in the Soviet Union, you would get it before you got a green card in the American system if you're an Indian. So these workers are highly skilled. So it's $60,000 minimum wage. The average wage for an H-1B worker is about $119,000 a year.
It's $65,000 per year plus another $25,000?
Yeah, $65,000 plus another $20,000 who are graduates for private companies. But nonprofit research institutions, including universities and the Cato Institute where I work, are exempt from that numerical cap. So they don't. So I actually compete with more immigrant workers than just about anybody in the country. And Brian, I guess too on this regard.
There's currently about
they're taking my job at Harvard.
750,000 or so H-1B visa.
The government doesn't actually count them because, of course, the government wouldn't count the interesting, important things. But those are some of the estimates of them. And so the argument recently is that these are taking the jobs of, hardworking blue-collar American workers in technology, science, engineering, and mathematics. There's not really much evidence of this. Firms hire H-1B visas. It's an expensive visa process when they're expanding and increasing their labor demand in the United States. It's a wonderful visa to bring skilled people here. There's a lot of problems with it. A lot of regulations I delete in that visa and that in that category to make it easier for people in it, but people are it's an amazing turn of events where people are blaming and don't like a high skilled visa for people, and we saw this in the great H-1B wars on Twitter, if everybody remembers that from a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean at least it's nice that people can admit the minimum wage can be harmful to the workers that are affected.
Hmm. Yeah. Let's talk.
I love the silver lining, Brian.
Let's talk a little bit about that because you know the anti-immigrant rhetoric or immigration restriction rhetoric is really coming from the right now. I mean, the left or you know the Republicans, Democrats sometimes walk up to it. In the 1990s, it was very different. Bill Clinton in 96 famously campaigned on getting rid of illegal immigrants and tightening things up. But, you know, so these things switch. But it's coming from the right. There was a big kind of squabble between kind of MAGA contingents who were saying, no, immigrants are terrible and H-1Bs, we should get rid of all of them. And then people like Elon Musk, who has the ear of the president, who works in industries that use a lot of H-1B visa people. And they say, you know, we need these people. Brian, how do you think that is likely to play out in a political coalition that is very much behind Donald Trump, who's very much anti-immigrant?
And I'd say that you should always start with the base rate, which is just the status quo. This is only, you know, even when people say they really want to change things, most often they don't. So I'd start with there. In terms of what's actually likely to happen, I mean, you're right. You've got two forces. You've got some very populist people saying, let's even go after high school immigration. And then on the other hand, you've got Elon saying that's a terrible idea. Net effect, you know, I guess I would still go with, I think it's going to be about the base rate. I don't think Elon is going to get them to expand it. I don't think the other people are likely to crush Elon and get it crushed. But I would also say I believe what Alex says more than what I say. So what do you say, Alex?
Thank you, Brian. It's really interesting because, you know, Elon came on one of these visas and he had visa troubles at different times. And he's a man who has produced more economic value than any other living person. And he would not have been able to do the same thing in South Africa, where he came from, to say nothing about that. But in terms of what's going to happen, I agree. I think things are actually going to get worse. I don't think Elon is going to have too much influence on the direction of immigration policy under the Trump administration. He might delay things a few weeks here or there, but it's sort of the same thing you see with like woke policies inside of government agencies, right? It's like you have a committed group of bureaucrats who are really into woke ideology, pushing it. And so no matter what the politicians say, it becomes larger and push and grows. And what you have is like the huge source of human capital in the American Republican Party now for managing agencies is in the immigration bureaucracy. They actually know what they're doing as opposed to a lot of other agencies. So you have a committed group of bureaucrats who are committed to this, the Stephen Millers of the world and dozens of other people who are just on the other side of this from Elon. And when Trump says publicly, like he said today, he likes the H-1B visa, he's like, I love waiters and the people who work at my resorts. He's confusing the H-1B with another visa called the H-2B visa.
Stunning. So he normally doesn't make that kind of mistake, right?
Yeah, well, I put it this way. My money is on people like Stephen Miller,
yeah,
who actually work in the government and are more trusted by the president than on Elon, even
yeah,
though
I
wish
Elon would win. You know, one of the things, we haven't had comprehensive immigration reform really since the late 80s when Ronald Reagan, who was exceedingly pro-immigration and a pro-immigrant, helped forge a synthesis, wasn't all good. We haven't been able to have comprehensive immigration reform. Is it possible that Stephen Miller, though, can put together a consensus for an exclusionary set of immigration policies?
I think it's very possible. It's certainly the highest chance that I've seen in my lifetime. For instance, there was just a bill passed that will be passed if it hasn't already today, the Lake and Riley Act.
Mm-hmm. Explain who Lake and Riley is.
Lake and Riley was a student in Georgia who was murdered by this illegal immigrant from Venezuela named, I believe it was Jose Ibarra. And Ibarra was recently convicted of that in Georgia in late 2024. So the Lake and Riley Act, and he had been arrested a couple times at different spots. So the Lake and Riley Act does two things. One of them, it says that if you're arrested for any kind of theft in the U.S. and you're an illegal immigrant, then they have to hold you in government detention and remove you. That doesn't really keep me up at night. But the third part of it, which is the part that is really popular in the Republican conference, if you talk to them off the record, it allows any state attorney general to sue the federal government for visa programs if it imposes more than $100 of cost on their state. And Steve Bannon and other people on the right are saying this is the vehicle they're going to use to shut down the H-1B program, any kind of humanitarian parole and other types of temporary work programs, because you can definitely show $100 of cost. You know, somebody goes on an H-1B to a state and they enroll their kids in public schools. So there's going to be this sort of it is a very fascinating way to empower states to basically some of them to try to shut down the legal immigration system.
Alex, I know you've done work on this, but how do you respond to people who are outraged that illegal immigrants, you know, are not just committing crimes, but are killing people? You know, what is a good libertarian response to that?
So I say you should punish the people who commit the crimes. You should not punish people who have the same legal status who didn't commit the crimes. In the same way that I would hope that if somebody, and like in my hometown of Herndon, somebody committed a murder not long ago. It was a big scandal, a big story. I'm glad they punished the murderer and not the neighbors who come from the same state, who happen to have the same immigration status as that individual. So I think you punished a person who did it. And then there's an empirical argument. Illegal immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than native-born Americans, to be incarcerated for them, to commit them according to the almost all the evidence, the really good evidence that we have. And so if you're using crime committed by a subpopulation that doesn't commit as much crime, and you're using that as an argument for mass deportations, that is an ineffective anti-crime policy that you're wasting resources on that you should be going against actual criminals, people who violate other people's rights.
Oh, if I could just say something on that, Nick. So once I actually was invited to be the one pro-immigration person at the Writers' Workshop, which is basically the giant umbrella organization of all the anti-immigration groups in America. And later that afternoon, there was a panel of people whose relatives had been murdered by illegal immigrants. And I was not on that panel. But I think, so what would you say to the people on that panel? And I think the honest thing is to say, I wouldn't say anything to the people on that panel. Someone who actually went through that horrible situation, like it's best to go, like say, like, I'm just not even going to touch that. But if you were talking to someone else who was not really personally affected, say, look, I understand why you're doing this, but intellectually, this is not any better than saying, let's have a panel of everyone murdered by a Jew, everyone murdered by an Albanian in order to go and stoke misanthropy against that group. Like logically, it does not in any way differ, except that this is a group that people are already dislike. But
I'm amazed they didn't have you on that panel.
I think I would have refused, but let's at least ask for more money.
let's talk about cultural arguments, Brian. You touched on this earlier. You know, a lot of people who are concerned about immigration will say, you know what, we have let so many people in. We're at the percentage of the foreign-born population is approaching the peaks that it saw in the early teens of the 20th century or previous peaks. And people are saying, you know, we need a timeout. We had a timeout, you know, starting in the 20s through the 60s or really the late 70s. And we need to stop the influx of different types of people with different types of lifestyles and different types of ways of being in the world. What is wrong with that argument?
I mean, there's so many different ways that you could start, but let me start with this one. My dad is 86. Do you think he likes modern American culture? All right. Since he was born, the culture not of immigrants, but of native-born Americans has dramatically changed to the point where he is horrified just to go and turn on his television. All right. Now, the question is, look, so how horrible was it really? Right now, those of us who are younger say, well, I guess there's some things that were better, some things are worse. I don't see the culture is worse overall. Probably it's actually a bit better. All right, that would, I think, be at least a more reasonable attitude to take about it. But then here's something that you can also say, well, who do you feel culturally closer to, my dad or an immigrant of your own generation? Like almost everyone says, yeah, of course I feel a lot closer to immigrants from my own generation than a guy who's 86 years old. He's just living in a totally different era. It's like, yeah, and yet we still have a highly functional society. We have the greatest economy that's ever existed. Despite all this cultural change, it seems like our system is actually very robust. I have an essay that's called Western Civ is a Hardy Weed. Our civilization actually is amazingly flexible, amazingly good at adapting. And this is what makes it so terrifying to the enemies of Western culture around the world. In Iran, the Ayatollah had a great word, West toxification. This is what the West is doing. They're sending their Western poison into Iran. And so we need to keep it out in order to save our country and our culture. And this is one where it's like people can be living in Iran and yet they feel bombarded by our culture. Right. And
well,
yet
who's
people come
pick
here.
That? Who's going to pick that weed? It's going to be an immigrant too, right? So it's like,
well, I mean, what's really striking is if you can't actually keep people in Iran from westernizing, what are the odds you can keep Iranian immigrants from that actually move to the West from westernizing? We've got Alex Narosta here and his dad, director Cyrus Narosta.
My grandparents were the immigrants.
Yes. So your dad was actually born here?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Under the new rules, by the way, that Trump put into effect, it's actually unclear whether he would be an American citizen, but he was born here now, yes. No.
Are you – I hope you're taunting him with that.
Very much so, and I told him that I'm going to call ICE on him. I think Brian's right. You know, when people get older, I think they find more things in American culture or any culture they grow up in to complain about. But next time you see this, I mean, you all look pretty young in here. But next time
also,
you find
also very good looking.
Well, some of us. Next time you think
no
of
Nordics.
Something,
no Nordics need apply.
Yeah. Next time you think of something in American culture that you don't like, think about: was this a foreign import, or is this something those crazy kids came up with? And I haven't found one that's not a foreign import. It's always those crazy kids.
Yeah, the good culture changes, starting with cuisine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Spicy food. Yeah.
Do you do either of you have concerns about a common culture and whether it's driven by immigration or internal migration or just technology? Are you overly concerned that, people will benchmark it going back, depending on how old they are or what they're interested in. But things were better in the early days of the internet. Things were better when we had 3 TV channels and a couple of trusted sources of news, when we all read the same books, things like that. Do those critiques or do those worries speak to you at all?
You know, I'd say the best case scenario is if we have a common, awesome culture. That's the best case scenario. On the other hand, we could have a common crummy culture, which is what we had when you're talking about when we had 3 channels of television and your trusted news sources that did not deserve to be trusted, but nevertheless were, right? And so, especially, of course, if you have a minority view, the idea that you want a common culture, well, who do you think is going to get assimilated, right? It's not going to be the rest of society starts being like you. It's that you're under pressure to start being like them. So I'd say, given the problems in mainstream culture, it's better that it's not common. At least there's some dissent. So during COVID, on the one hand, you've got this very popular view of lockdowns, but on the other hand, there's a lot of dissent. Much better that it wasn't. I think the best thing would have been if there's a common culture saying no lockdowns. But if you're not going to get that, it's better to have polarization. So at least there's some place in the U.S. you can go to be free.
Alex, is there any reason to believe that assimilation, and it would be worth defining that term, is it happening at a different rate than it happened in the early part of the 20th century or at other points of high immigration in United States history?
So there's been some good work on this. Jake Vigdor and others have tried to take a look at this over time. And by assimilation, he basically means whether the immigrants or their kids are similar to longer settled Americans along measurements of education, income, family size, religiosity, civic participation, and some other metrics of opinion. And he finds that it's going at about the same pace as 100 years ago. Mexicans are pretty similar to Italians in terms of their pace of assimilation along a lot of these metrics. One of the big ways that people assimilate is through intermarriage, called assimilation at the altar. That's one of the major reasons why you have large descendants of Hispanic immigrants in the United States who don't even identify as Hispanic on surveys. So they actually are so well blended in and so successful that they just identify as white because they've, one of their parents is white or one of their grandparents is. So no, the trends are pretty positive, and they didn't improve when the borders were closed in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. The pace of assimilation for Italians was basically unchanged, even when the borders were closed. What's true is when you close off immigration, you don't have that stock of new immigrants. So it probably seems like, oh, assimilation's increasing, but it's not increasing at a different rate than it was
before. This was the problem with, particularly in the 90s in Southern California, where there was a constant flow mostly from Mexico of new Spanish speakers. So it seemed as if nobody was learning English. But if you actually tracked generations, by the third generation, essentially nobody spoke the mother tongue predominantly.
I mean, the Spanish lasts a little longer into the third generation in a lot of cases. But what's interesting, like I grew up in Southern California.
Not that they don't know English, but they retain Spanish.
Yeah, it's like it's 100% English fluency. But then, you know, they say they speak Spanish. Like my father says he speaks Farsi and he speaks it with a Wisconsin accent like he's 5 years old. Like, yeah, right. It's like he jibber jabber tater tots. Like it's like the way that he talks. It's hilarious. But, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Southern California, most of the people I knew who were Hispanic spoke with an accent. I go back now and they all have this nasally accent like I do. They sound like they're native born. I mean, they are native born Americans. They sound like me and Brian.
Yeah, my favorite debate on this was against Mark Krikorian, head of the Center for Immigration Studies, probably the leading anti-immigration think tank in the world. And he had this bizarre statement, which he then clarified. He said, look, immigration is like donuts. Immigration's like donuts. What does that mean? Well,
delicious.
Yes, not his word. He says, "Look, when you're young, you can stuff your face with donuts, eat all you want, and you're fine. You don't get fat. But once you're old, if you keep eating that way, you're going to be a big, fat, disgusting pig." He says, and that's how immigration is for countries. A young country can stuff its face with immigrants; it's all fine. But a mature country can't. And I'm like, all right, that's an analogy, but like, what are you, what are you talking about? And then he said something much more thoughtful. He said, well, look, back in the 19th century, when an immigrant came to the U.S., they had to assimilate because the costs of communication and transportation were so high due to the technology at the time that they basically were never going to go back, were barely in contact with the people from the home country. So they had to assimilate back then, whereas now you can move here and physically and yet psychologically remain a citizen of your home country. I've got a colleague whose wife is from Taiwan, and she basically just lives in Taiwan in Virginia. She just watches Taiwanese television, talks to relatives in Taiwan. She's not assimilating at all. All right. So, all right. There's something in what you're saying, Mark, but you are forgetting that in the same way that transportation and communication technologies allow someone here to not assimilate, they also allow someone who isn't here to assimilate. In 1900, there were not many Sicilians speaking fluent English who were up to date on modern American culture at the time because the communication and transportation was so expensive, whereas now the world is full of people who are what my student Nathaniel Smith calls pre-assimilated. They've never been in the West, but they're very Western. I was just in India and I met hundreds of pre-assimilated people, people whose English is fluent, people who know more about America than about their own country. They are totally ready to hit the ground running in a way that basically no one in India would have been 100 years ago. So yeah, it makes sense that we're not seeing much change overall because we got two conflicting forces. And in fact, right now we've got like a billion people who are on Earth who are ready to be Americans without any further ado. They already are in their own minds.
How, let's say a billion people want to move here, which strikes me as high, or rather the number who would take the next step. You know, how many people do you think the U.S. could assimilate? Or not assimilate, but just, you know, take it?
Over the course of a century, I think we could
course of 5 years.
5 years. So in 5 years, I think we would get 20 to 30 million, right? There's just a lot of people who currently have friends and relatives here and who they could sleep on their couch. These are the people who pretty much already have their bags packed. As soon as they get the green light, they'll be here. So, of course, that also solves a lot of other problems. Well, who's going to take care of them? Yeah, it's going to be their friends and relatives. Something just to understand like how high the potential is. The U.S. population has multiplied about 100 times since the founding of the country. 100 times. If you had told people in 1789, we can have 100 times as many people in this country, I think they just would have thought you were crazy. It sounds crazy, but it happened. Same thing, United Arab Emirates. Their population has multiplied by a factor of 34 in 50 years. It really has. That's facts. That's not speculation. And is it a disaster? It's like, no, it is awesome. Go there. Don't go there when it's 110 degrees, but go there and just look. This is not theory. This is what is actually possible to unlock by moving human talent to a place where it's productive.
Alex, to wrap up, what are you most worried about over the next 4 years? And what do you, you know, what is something positive that you think will emerge from kind of the current turmoil over immigration?
I am most worried about legal changes that reduce legal immigration to the United States, changes in statutes, new bills being passed, because as Brian said earlier, it's very difficult to undo a law once you put it into effect. I think if they reduce the number of green cards, that would be a disaster. Most of the actions that Trump has taken so far could be undone by the next president if they wanted to. Laws passed by Congress, not so much. So what I'm most worried about is that they'll reduce it, and then it'll be very difficult to get it back.
Do you see anything positive coming out of this kind of renewed antagonism towards immigration?
I think that we could see some reductions in immigrant access to welfare benefits. I guess I have to put something positive on it. That could be the most positive thing that I see. Listen, I mean, Donald Trump ran both times on a platform to reduce legal immigration. He ran on that. He said it multiple times. People try to fool you and gaslight you into saying he's against just illegal immigration. It's not true. So I think that he means it. He did it last time. He's going to do it again.
Brian, what about you? What do you worry the most about over the next, 4 years?
Yeah, so my worry is the same as Alex. I would say that the probability of something actually going through, remembering how partisan it is and how polarized the U.S. is, I would only give that like 15-20%. So ultimately, it's a concern. It's not one that seems terrible. And I'd also give 5 or 10% that Doge and Elon do something awesome. Like people have underestimated that guy a bunch of times. And yes, there's people saying maybe he's totally evil and terrible. It's possible. But all right, I don't know him that well. But on the other end, he's also done some great things. And it's just so weird and chaotic. And just the things that are happening, just the way Trump talks about Greenland. And I'm like, what the hell? And then it's one time, no, he's talking about it all the time. Just the variance of what can occur.
Maybe what we could do is let in Greenlands. And we say, okay, only open borders for Greenland.
Yeah.
And then we use that as a bridge. Yeah.
I don't know. It's getting, it's pretty crowded.
They'll go to Emirates. They will go to Greenland. They totally would.
No. All right. We're going to end the conversation here. We've been talking with Alex Naraso of the Cato Institute and Brian Kaplan of George Mason about the libertarian case for more immigration. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.